Pop quiz, hotshot. Who do you think is the most powerful group of people in the United States? Time's up. It's old people. You want to know why? Because old people are the only folks who vote in all these boring elections that happen between presidential contests. Do you know what old people want to change? Nothing. Do you know what scares old people? Everything new or different. Now, I love old people. They're always there with the hard candy and whatnot. But when it comes to issues of social and political import, I'll bet you and grandma see things a little bit differently. Because people our age don't vote, old people get to choose state and municipal lawmakers. These are the offices that end up deciding crucially important things, such as who gets access to healthcare and who gets to vote in the next big election. Boring elections are incredibly fast and easy to vote in because no one's there. And because turnout is so low, your vote will have a huge impact. You'll be doing what's best for everybody by going to vote411.org and finding out when the next boring election is and where you can vote. That's vote411.org. Tell them Xerxes sent you.
Some, this is painfully obvious, but hardcore gaming means it ain't for the novices. The main source to brain train your knowledge, a lane maintained with a course aimed at colleges. To HG101, we give the honor, thanks to Kirk, a lot of Xerxes to host it proper, as well as Satanga, Cal and Bobinator, Hooker, Hart, and others discuss and discover all the 47,000 games, and when they rate them, you can bet it's scientifically locked in position. Speaking of which, no system is obscure, and look, they wrote a book about it, go out and cop yours.
Hello and welcome to HardcoreGaming101.net's Top 47,858 Games of All Time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games that you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and I'm the show's main host and producer, and on this podcast we have three rules. Rule 1, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule 2, you can nominate one game at a time via 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. Those are the ones we try to get to first. You can also go to bit.ly/rankthisplease and add a game to the slush pile and cross your fingers. We make no guarantees on those. Rule number 3, you can nominate games that have already been nominated, but just don't nominate games you've already ranked. See the master list for yourself. It's at bit.ly/47kgames. That's bit.ly/47kgames.
Stop whining! Let's jump in the tub.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. For this episode, we're going to be talking about a little game called Radical Dreamers. It was developed by Square. It was published by Square for the Super Nintendo. It was first released on February 3rd, 1996 in Japan for the... it wasn't really the Super Nintendo. It was like the Super Nintendo, Satellaview, whatever, right?
It was exclusive to the Satellaview and remains exclusive to the Satellaview because the guy that made it is... Allegedly thinks that it's a little bit embarrassing, and he would like to go back and rewrite parts of it, and so has soft vetoed it until he does that. So you'll never see it again. Thanks, everyone.
Who's with me to talk about Radical Dreamers?
I'm Carl.
And I'm Word on the Wind.
Okay, so okay, Radical
Drake's
Dreamers.
Joining us.
What? What?
Oh, I thought I heard a can go.
Oh, you haven't heard it yet.
Oh, I have?
Oh, there we go. The yeah.
All right.
You know how I'm feeling about this one. So Radical Dreamers, it's interesting. It's the first of two sequels to Chrono Cross.
Hold on.
Chrono Cross, Chrono Trigger, right.
Mm. Yeah. Chrono Cross is the other one.
Yep. Chrono Cross is the other sequel that kind of slightly retcons this one. It's a text adventure, would you say?
It's basically like a choose your own sort of thing. It's basically a visual novel, adventure game, whatever you want to call it. It's
somewhere between a VN and a choose your own adventure. Yeah.
Like the actual way I would describe it in a modern context is it's a Twine game. That's it. Like,
well, those are supposed to be text adventures.
Yes, but because this one's quite willing to mix things up a little bit. Sometimes it will. It's got combat in it. It's got some random sequences and random events and stuff. It's got little bits and pieces. It's not just a singular straight through story with choices. For the most part, it is, but it has like some stuff. It keeps track of a few stats and things that it throws back at you across the game. There's like just a little bit more game than you might anticipate based on the presentation and overall appearance of it. But And also, even though it is a text adventure, it does have quite a bit of art. Not art for everything, but quite a decent amount. I was considering that I'd had it described as a text adventure to me. The game has quite a bit of art, between setting the scene with, characters, you know, moving through environments and, like animated doors opening, Resident Evil sort of style. And, a lot of the scenes as described will actually appear in some semblance of thing. The few characters and stuff and things that you'll engage with, quite a few of them actually have art that comes into the screen. They even got like blinking and stuff, you know, so.
You'll occasionally see characters striding across the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's also got a fair amount of atmospheric sound effects, as I recall.
Oh, boy.
It's
first
one
time
of
I played this,
thing.
It was actually kind of scary.
It has quite a bit of tension to it, which because I've seen people describe the game, including one absolutely savage review, which I will not call out, because, this review's like, it gave the game like a 1 out of 5, and it's like, it's irredeemably bad, and you don't do anything. And I was like, dang, this person hates this.
Person's also wrong.
I do agree. But I thought, like, so it's going to be, like, mixed, and I'd seen, like, a lot of people downplay it, except for the text and the audio, but no, it's actually pretty damn solid. You know, it's got, some of the stuff is, yeah, like, you got dripping sounds and rumbling, and whoever was doing the sound, I think it was the person who does the Chrono Trigger music itself, also the Chrono Cross soundtrack. Well, definitely the Chrono Cross soundtrack, I know that for absolute sure, for reasons I'll mention later. Really cool, and lots of, no talking, but sometimes there'll be, like, the sort of audio is talking where, like, they'll be screaming, so they'll just hit, like, the throttle on the sound chip, and you'll be like, and really, like, crank it into your ears, and you're like, ooh.
One more time for the people up top.
No, my throat is now disintegrated. I can no longer talk.
Somehow I doubt that, but, yeah.
Oh, thanks.
How does this relate to Chrono Trigger?
It is a sequel such and such in that it allegedly takes place afterwards and has to do with various events thereof. It's not really super clear.
So
it's kind of like, it's like one of those sequels in sort of kind of name only.
The big thing is, I won't actually go over it because there's a couple of connections to the game of Chrono Trigger. Some are extremely obvious. My partner, who is a huge Chrono Trigger fan, or at least a relatively, is thrilled. The moment one of the characters was talked about in this game, she was just like, immediately, like, it's that one. Like, just immediately, it's that character from that game. And if you play it and you know Chrono Trigger, you'll be like, oh yeah, it's that. Like, it's really obvious, and that's never outright stated, but it is so blatant about it.
Yeah.
There is a second character, and there is some extra tie-in stuff that is the main reveal of this one as such. Like, the story ostensibly is a trio, Surge, Kid, and McGill. Love the name, McGill. McGill, the, like, sorcerer. He's coming in with his sorcery, his shadow magic, and his tall mysteriousness.
You tall mysterious sorcery student, I hereby dub thee by the mysterious sorcery name. It's coming to me. It's hang on. I've got it. McGill the Magnificent. Get out of here. Go.
Also, so they decide, or they're going to rob a priceless jewel called the Frozen Flame, which actually looks quite cool. The effect is very nice on the system. Mm. It's highlighted multiple times. It's a multifaceted, geode kind of, like, spikes all over it kind of reddish thing. I'm describing it because it looks really cool in this NES. This game uses quite a few, like, demo scene-y style effects to look really nice when it wants to. Like, if you like that kind of...
This game makes use of the, hey, we can do, you know, polygons and polygon-based visuals. So they do polygon-based visuals, not actual polygons, though.
Yeah, they've got their SGI or SCI, SGIs, right? SGI workstations, I think, at this point. So they're just cranking out random pieces of 3D art to to litter the graphics with. But at the same time, they're doing, like, let's palette shift and have all of the parallax and stuff sometimes. Looks pretty cool in places. And so they're just going to steal this jewel from some jackass named Lynx. And Kid freaking hates Lynx, and it's heavily implied that they're going to stab the hell out of him. But Surge, who you play as, is like, we're just going to steal the jewel, right?
I'm just a thief. Well, strictly speaking, I think he's a bard in this. He's like a minstrel or something.
But he doesn't actually
carry an instrument.
As a wandering, vagrant musician who somehow got involved with Kid and Miguel, and they have invited him along with them. Even though he can't fight, doesn't know how to thief, and is generally incompetent.
I don't know. He can fight. And he's
he
not
can fight. The implication is he doesn't really know how, at least from the writing, because he's all like, the way he
describes
it.
He's not a trained fighter. He's like, he knows how, and he can hold his own, but, you know, he's not going to be going into, like, every situation going, oh, I can totally take him. He's very more reserved about, like, okay, this is risky, but we got no choice, so let's go.
Meanwhile, Kid in every fight is like, stab him! Go stab him! And you're like, I don't know about this. And yeah, one thing that
Kid
I really like
is very aggressive.
Something I really think is funny is the very first combat sequence. I don't think it even gives you the choice in any of the others. It lets you choose to try and use magic. And if you try, Surge is like, I try and say the spell that I know. And he like can't remember how to cast magic. So he just gets his ass beat if you try and use it. And if you try and use it a second time, he will continue to get his ass beat, which I like.
Look, it's been a few years since high school, okay?
Yeah.
Remember exactly how to cast Lightning 3,
right? Can't get it under control when the cats are trying to murder him. So yeah, you basically just knife some things. And you basically explore they describe it as a manor, even though all of the graphics, it's clearly a castle. We are all using what I believe was the Demoforge translation from like quite early on.
Neo Demiforce?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my god, Cal.
What?
How can you not know the Neo Demiforce?
I don't know anything about anything. Seriously. Don't ask me any questions.
This, as I recall, because I'm an old man who remembers old timey things, I recall this being like one of the major translation projects of the early Super NES emulation scene. Yep. And so it was like Final Fantasy V and this.
I mean, this is a big one because obviously Chrono Trigger was and continues to be a beloved classic. So people spreading notes to each other like, did you know Chrono Trigger had a sequel and it wasn't the really bad one called Chrono Cross? And, you know, that's whispers all over the internet. I don't care what you think of Chrono Cross. That's the, you know, the idea that there's this
I know, but I can be mad about rumors.
like Chrono sequel game that's in the ether of Japan. Yeah,
I was aware of this game before Chrono Cross came out, but I don't think I played it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it was, I don't think it had been translated.
It was not, Chrono Cross came out before the translation for this was available.
Can confirm.
The other thing about this one, by the way, before we, I guess, get too far into the game, as we said, it was on the SATAview, which is an infamous emulation and archival nightmare, because it was all sent out in broadcasts, and you had to download them to your SNES SATAView, and you had to have satellite stuff set up, and people were deleting games, and games had limited plays, and there was so many things preventing games from that system from being saved. To this day, there are games that are not actually complete with all their broadcasts around. But this one, in a rare case of the SATAView, is basically, it was broadcast plenty of times, nice and late enough that people kept it. And it didn't have any restrictions. It wasn't restricted on a time limit. It wasn't restricted on a play limit. In fact, it wants you to play it a total of like at least 8 times if you really want to be crazy.
Something around there, yeah.
So this one was actually like one of the easiest to get running SATAView games. So that's why, even though it's SATAView, it was super available compared to some of the other things that are, you know, barely managed to get running today. I like the Satell view. I think it's a really cool thing.
I remember in the mid to late, probably the mid 90s, Nintendo Power made the mistake of publishing like photos or screens, I guess, of the NES Legend of Zelda SNES remake that was done on Satellaview.
and where, like, I think, is that the one where Link's wearing a ball cap, or is that not? That's the, maybe that's the Link to the Past one.
There is one that has Link replaced with, like, the Satellaview mascot, and I think that may have been one of the earlier iterations of it.
Yeah, you can play as either mascot, because there's a boy gender and a girl gender, like, you can choose either representation as your avatar, and you can play as either of them, I believe, in the Satellaview Zelda, I think.
I was convinced that was coming out, because I recall the caption or something being like, we don't know if this is ever going to reach the United States, but there is a remake of the original Zelda.
And it's not even
Nintendo.
It's
not
a
remake, but like a you know, like is Super Mario All-Stars, right? It wasn't insane to think that they would actually do this.
But
and I was thinking like, oh my God, they're going to make a Legend of Zelda All-Stars. I've got to get this. I was watching out for it and never came. Not even close. There's never any intention of doing that. Why even show?
No, no intention ever. The Satellaview was never nothing.
I was, and then I was like, well, they didn't give me that, but Metroid 64 is gonna happen.
And if I don't get that, at least Mother is on its way.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, now we're getting to the point where I'm sad.
But this one did manage to eventually get salvaged and translated. The translation patch is pretty solid. I definitely believe it is a localization patch. I say that because while the main story is, I believe, quite close to literal, they're basically when the game is, as we said, you play through it, there's some random encounters, you go through some very descriptive environments, you explore a castle, you solve some very basic, I found this item, I have to go to this location, and then the game will basically let you activate it, kind of puzzles, nothing very particularly difficult. And then you'll eventually reach the end of it, essentially. It's not very challenging.
There are traps that show up from here to here, and then it's like, oh, hey, we set this thing off, so, like, we need to get out of here, or we're gonna fucking die. Or, well,
you
we did
this,
this
right?
We can't go this way.
Can you actually be
this?
Defeated in this? Is that a thing that can happen?
I've never died to traps, but, like, I've never wanted to test that one.
Exactly. It never felt like it was going to kill me unless I did something deliberately stupid continuously.
Right. Yeah, which, you know, is the way you want to do that.
Yeah, so I was
it's
not
kinda
gonna
like,
push it.
It's kind of like the gorillas at the local zoo. They probably won't kill you unless you do something stupid continuously.
I will
and
mention.
Force their hand.
There is one bit that I used a save state to test because I thought it was too funny. There is a point, and I won't tell you how you end up with it, but there is a point where you end up with a sword, and you have to use the sword, and you have a few choices, and one of them is to stab Kid! And so I save stated to test it because I'm like, oh, I have to see what the game is going to do if I try and stab the other, like, major character. So, but the game does stop you. It doesn't even let you game over on that. The two characters just, like, they look at you, and it describes in text as they're not on the screen. But it's just, like, they look at you, and then just, like, what are you doing? And Miguel just immediately, like, casts a spell on your ass and knocks you to the ground, like, I don't know what you're doing, but don't do whatever you're thinking.
Like, I don't know what you're thinking, but I don't like the way you're looking about it.
Because you're obviously holding this sword, and you're like, well, maybe that's the solution to the puzzle. But where I was getting mildly sidetracked is once you beat the game, it unlocks the rails as such, and it has about 6 or 7 separate paths that you can now move through in the game. And what that ultimately means is it opens up a few more options that weren't there before. So if you do a specific series of things, instead of going on the true storyline, you'll go into like a weird seg. By weird seg, I mean the game will become a horror story and the characters will actually have completely different backgrounds. Or actually a character is now a space pirate and you're hunting space like criminals and stuff. Like,
all in on that.
It just
it's just like alt reality mode.
Yeah, like the game starts as normal, and then instead of revealing the characters as it reveals them as completely different people with completely different motivations, and it does feel a bit like you know, well, this game's only like an hour long at best, so we're just gonna do some writing, you know, we're just gonna throw some other stuff in, really make it crazy. But the reason I mentioned all that in relation to the translation is there was a Seinfeld joke in there, and so I'm assuming that was pretty, like, that was localization from the translators. Because I somehow don't think there was a Seinfeld joke in the Japanese
original. What was the joke?
What was the... I remember reading it, and I was like, Hell, that's straight out of Seinfeld. Oh, it was the jerk store called, and they're all out of you. That's in there.
Hey,
in
the- hey, George. The ocean called, and they're running out of shrimp.
He was riffing and scatting all over the place.
From what I remember, Demi Force was kind of one of the, not like one of the more majorly, oh, we're just going to do whatever the hell we please with this script types, but was not afraid to just put shit that was not even remotely there in the first place.
Because these, the, like, side things that you unlock after are quite, like, wacky, so I'm pretty sure they were probably really... maybe esoteric or obtuse Japanese jokes, which...
possibly.
Some of them could have been... A lot of those jokes could have been, like, yeah, really, like, in-jokey type thing in Japan that we would not get. And so why not turn it into a Seinfeld joke?
Yeah, like, that's how I feel about it. Like, ultimately, I don't need strict accuracy if I'm just going to be like, what? So that's that's more than fair, I think. The core game appears to be pretty true to type anyway. So, you know, you get all that you could ever want. It's well worth checking out. Music is phenomenal. Between the sound being really cool in terms of actually atmospheric, as we said. So really, like, I mean, if you haven't done like one of these like things where you it's a novel, you read it, and it just cranks out atmosphere at you. It really, like, you know, it enhances the experience of the reading. Why wouldn't it? That's a.
It's also worth mentioning that a bunch of the tracks are reused in Chrono Cross, some with slight variations, others not really any. So it's interesting to, if you've played that game, to come into this one and go, oh, hey, this track has some history behind it.
Yes, it feels like the compositions were too good to leave just on the Sata view, where almost no one would have, you know, outside of the 100,000 people that had the system at the time, would never have probably gotten it. So I can see why it would be like, this is a good song, I'm just going to use slightly different instruments and then crank it out again.
Man, the Chrono Cross soundtrack is a thing for the ages. But I think we should just move on to ranking this. There's not much more you can say about it.
I'm not
going to
crank out
the...
much more. I got one tiny thing. It's a criticism. It's probably the biggest criticism I can level at it. It has random encounters, and I can't tell how the algorithm for them is generated, but it's possible to get like a lot of them in quick succession, and it can get pretty exhausting because there's only a fairly small pool of random encounters, and sometimes the solutions seem to be semi-random, like I've done an action that worked, and then the next time it fails, and I don't know quite how it's figuring that out, but there's only so many times I can fight the skeleton or fight the goblin before I'm like, yes, I know, the goblins are here, step back, stab him, trip him, stab him. You know, once you've read that like six times, you're like, yeah, I get it, stop giving me this goblin encounter, it's no longer
you're
interesting
out the
in
game
any way.
Here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Get me to the space pirate part.
Yeah, like, especially since, obviously, this is an older text kind of game, so you don't have skip read text, you know, fast forward. The text, you can set it to fast, and it does go pretty quick, but, you know, I don't like to have to sit there and press the A button over and over and over and over and over.
I would like to throw out that I did appreciate how, like, at the very beginning of the game, the first thing that the game asks you is, what is the text speed? And it's like, do you want fast or do you want slow? And then in parentheses, straight from the translator, is, le slow es le più.
I remember that.
Too slow, we got rid of it.
Yeah, I think... the last, really quickly, can either of you explain how this fits into Chrono Cross?
Basically, it doesn't. Chrono Cross retcons this out of existence. Like, it's non-canon at this point, because, like, Megiddo is
Chrono
different,
Cross is
Link's
the
is different,
game.
Surge is different. About the only one that's basically the same are Kid and another minor character who is one of the many party members in Chrono Cross, but yeah, like outside of that, there's only two characters that are roughly the same, and the other one is different.
I mean, the main piece of game that I think we don't want to work around is basically when writing this. I'm sorry, I don't know, I can't remember the gentleman who was like the lead on this writing. Was basically like, I like the dynamic, I like where I was going with this, so I decided in Chrono Cross essentially to expand on this and you know, like add more and sort of get into these characters more. Like, that's really the main thing, is the kind of, this is almost like a proto run on the characters that he would write into Chrono Cross. Like, that's the main thing.
Does anything in it show up in Chrono Cross? Because for some reason I have this weird memory that it does.
The Frozen Flame definitely does.
Well, I mean, like, does any reference to this, not reference to the stuff that happens in the game, but rather like reference to the game being like another reality or something?
No.
Maybe I'm misremembering this.
No. I mean, this game itself does some weird, like, split reality thing. Like, every time the game starts, it ostensibly is like, this is a story about these ones. And when it ends, it says, and there was other ones who had very similar stories in a different time, but in the same place. Like, there's some, the framing device is a little.
And it's all the fault of that big tubby robot. Thanks.
Hey, what? Yes. Robo's nice. I
blame you.
I thought you were talking about Gato.
Oh, the punching one?
Yeah. That one's tubby.
Well, I wasn't, but now I am.
I don't care for Gato compared to Robo. But
Gato's something like I'm made of brass. Fuck with me. I'll kick your ass.
Okay. We're going to have to rank this one.
Can we rank that little couplet there? So where do we want to put Radical Dreamers?
I'm pretty fond of this one. If I'm being entirely real, my hot take, I like this the most of the three games.
That is the hottest of takes, and we will not discuss it further.
Oh, I don't intend to. I think highly of it is the core of it.
It is really cool for what it is. I mean, with that.
You had a sad of you, I'd be like, this is one of the best things on the system.
Look, this is... You think this is a Satellaview mover?
Mm-hmm. I do.
A killer app for the Satellaview.
Yeah, this is BS Zelda.
Oh, I tried to do some math. Thank you for reminding me. I'm like, if you liked Chrono Trigger and you heard that Chrono Trigger had a pseudo sequel on the Satellaview, you know, you're in Japan, right? And you're like, I need to get a Satellaview to play this damn thing. I think I did some math, and I think you would be out like $800 to play it.
It was including plane tickets or imports.
That's if you were Japanese. That's just converting.
Yeah, because. You gotta buy the Satellaview, which was like hundreds of US dollars. You gotta buy the satellite receiver. You gotta get a satellite receiver subscription. You gotta get a Satellaview subscription. There's so much money involved in setting this whole thing up.
Yeah, the Satellaview stuff is for like rich assholes, is what
it was for, like rich assholes who already had most of the stuff and were like, whatever. What's another $400?
It's people who already own like, you know.
Because this is also the PlayStation was available simultaneously.
Right.
Was out at the same time.
Whatever. You're really into satellite stuff, and it's like, yeah, I don't know, Dad will pay for everything, so.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, just log in.
I'll do this, and I might preserve some of it for history, but probably not. Come on. Where do we want to put Radical Dreamers? And we're going to have to do this quickly, because... Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I said I would put this really high, and I know I'm not ever going to get this.
Okay, so where would you put it if you were going to make a reasonable?
That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing. I don't have any particular point of comparison, but just on a lark, I'd throw it at 144.
Okay, why?
I feel it's compelling and actually, you know, kind of thrilling the first time you go through it, and then when you go through it the successive times, like, it offers you all kinds of new things where it's just like, what the hell is going to happen next? It's, you know, it's like the initial story is thrilling and interesting, and, you know, other than the encounters getting kind of, you know, samey and tedious, it doesn't really otherwise have any real issues for what it's trying to do.
True. For those playing along at home, what she's saying is that she would put it below Descent and above Diablo 2.
The number's just kind of out there. I don't like Diablo 2, so I'd rather play this over that.
Yeah, that's pretty high, so...
Certainly for me, at 206, we have Tex Murphy, the Pandora Directive, which is me trying to fuddle for games that are at least kind of in the same general field and try and figure out whether it's, you know, better or worse than that kind of thing.
Which is the Pandora Directive again? Just give me a number.
Is it 5?
It's the fifth one.
Oh, which one that's the like Tex remake? Murphy games?
Yeah,
yeah. It's number whatever out of who cares.
It's the one after the Killing Moon, I believe.
Yeah, nobody cares.
Sorry if that doesn't help.
We don't care. I don't care.
I care. It's actually an important question.
Tex Murphy Adventures, famous for sucking. All right, so, okay.
Oh, there's a hot take.
Yeah, well,
here's what it brings to the table. Let me put this out here. Okay, so weird use of very weird hardware that is kind of unique in that respect. It does things with the Super Nintendo hardware in particular that, well, you see them in other games, but you never see them in this kind of game. And it's fast. It's very easy to recommend because of how fast it is to go through and how much there's like, you know, you can like see the other versions of the story and stuff like that. I think I don't want to put it as high as Word does, but I actually think it compares favorably to, say, I think it's definitely better than Tex Murphy, the whatever. And nobody cares about it, though. I know I'm saying this on like the community that cares most about adventure games ever. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I know. I understand about that, but I don't care about Tex Murphy, so I'm going to say what I feel. And I think it's got to go below stuff like... it goes below that stuff. I mean, it's got to go below Bushido Blade because, I mean, come on. But around there, I'm okay with, like, in that area. And the reason why I'm okay with it is kind of what I said. Is like, I feel like it's just so weird and it's not hard to do. It's not hard to get. And it's, you can play through it really quickly and it does a lot of interesting stuff. And it's a great kind of, aperitif, shall we say, to like visual novels and text adventures for people who might not be inclined to give those genres a try. We're done. So it goes below Gepi X. It goes above Todd's Adventures in Slime World. And although I'm saying that as if I don't like this game, I actually do like it. And I do think it's like, it doesn't cost you much it costs you nothing in terms of dollars to play this game. And it will cost you very little in terms of time. And
can I argue it up to above Ghost Bebel because it doesn't have any game-breaking bugs?
I think that you're kind of stuck. It's got to go below Bushido Blade for sure.
That's fine. Put it at 191. Ghost Bebel has a...
I also think it goes below Gepi X. Gepi X is too weird and fantastic to pass up. But this is a similar game. It's just in the sense that it's like you got to really kind of check it out. It costs you nothing. Nothing but a little bit of time, and you'll probably like it. And that should be your kind of step into a larger world of either visual novels or adventure games. That's where it goes. Thanks, everybody. We will see you next episode. That's all for this episode. Special thanks goes out to our lovely co-hosts and compatriots, our theme song MC Norm, check him out at Normally Retro on Twitter, and our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter Ed Burns. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101. I know, I did. By subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, and by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. You can also hang out with us at our Discord channel. It's at bit.ly/HG Discord. But most importantly, help us spread the love of games by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it because you like us and you want us to succeed. Until next time, keep keeping it real.